Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary health care services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret will be speaking with Dr. John McDonough, director of the Center for Health Leadership at the Harvard School of Public Health. In the Tech Report segment, Marianne O'Hare looks at new technology that turns laser light into a minuscule invisible knife. And we begin with this week's bright idea.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. In one of the most popular TED Talks of all time, game developer Dr. Jane McGonigal made a pretty bold prediction.
If we want to solve problems like hunger, poverty, climate change, global conflict, obesity, I believe that we need to aspire to play games online for at least 21 billion hours a week by the end of the next decade. No, I'm serious. I am.
McGonigal is the director of games research and development at the Institute for the Future, and she's a thought leader in the growing trend of the gamification of improving health and social well-being through interactive video games. But she didn't realize that her prediction would come home to roost on her own doorstep. After suffering a severe concussion in 2009, she succumbed to the classic symptoms of traumatic brain injury: constant pain, chronic headaches, fog, depression, even suicidal ideation.
In all seriousness, suicidal ideation is quite common with traumatic brain injuries. It happens to one in three, and it happened to me. My brain started telling me, "Jane, you want to die." It said, "You're never going to get better." It said, "The pain will never end." And these voices became so persistent and so persuasive that I started to legitimately fear for my life.
So she created the game Super Better. McGonigal's research shows that when people engage in gaming, they're more likely to reach out for help, to empower themselves through their game avatar, and to use the avatar to slay the symptoms they're battling. In her own case, Buffy the Vampire Slayer provided the inspiration, so McGonigal's avatar became Jane the Concussion Slayer.
Now, the game was that simple. Adopt a secret identity, recruit your allies, battle the bad guys, activate the power-ups. But even with a game so simple, within just a couple days of starting to play, that fog of depression and anxiety went away. It just vanished. It felt like a miracle.
Within a year, the other symptoms, the headache and the fog, dissipated and went away. She decided to put the game online for anyone to access, and the feedback totally unexpected.
Now, what happened next with the game surprised me. I put up some blog posts and videos online explaining how to play, but not everybody has a concussion, obviously. Not everyone wants to be the slayer. So I renamed the game Super Better. And soon I started hearing from people all over the world who were adopting their own secret identity, recruiting their own allies, and they were getting super better, facing challenges like cancer and chronic pain, depression and Crohn's disease. Even people were playing it for terminal diagnoses like ALS.
Now McGonigal is working with the U.S. military to assist the hundreds of thousands of GIs dealing with traumatic brain injury and PTSD. She says that the game revealed a phenomena that scientists call post-traumatic growth, where some people experience dramatic growth after a traumatic event. The game just seems to get people to that place more quickly. Super Better, a simple online game that allows players grappling with all kinds of conditions to battle their symptoms in order to better manage and hopefully defeat their condition. Now that's a bright idea.
We're speaking today with Dr. John McDonough, director of the Center for Public Health Leadership at the Harvard School of Public Health, where he's also a professor. He served as the senior advisor on the National Health Reform to the United States Senate, helping to craft the Affordable Care Act. Before that, Dr. McDonough was the executive director of Healthcare for All in Massachusetts, where he played a key role in the passage and implementation of the 2006 Massachusetts Health Reform Law. He's a regular contributor to the publication Health Affairs in the New England Journal of Medicine, and is author of three books, including Inside National Health Reform, published in 2011. Dr. McDonough, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Nice to be here with you.
John, now, you were one of the chief architects of both the health care law in Massachusetts as well as the Affordable Care Act, the latter you describe as having just survived its third near-death experience with the re-election of President Obama. Its future seems secure yet murky in some respects as opponents continue to mount new challenges and various states are responding differently to certain aspects of the health law. And in your 2011 book, Inside National Health Reform, you say that there would have been a much better way to craft a health care law, but that it was the best that could have been achieved given the political realities. What would have made it more meaningful, and what were some major obstacles?
Well, it's the first comprehensive health reform law that's ever been passed in the history of the United States. It includes coverage, reform of the delivery system, prevention and public health, workforce, so many other key elements that touch and address nearly every part of the system. And at the same time, if you talk to the experts and the people who know each of those parts of the system best, every one of them can point out a dozen ways that the law could have been stronger. In the coverage and access part, the subsidies for people purchasing health insurance could have been more robust and provided greater income protection. The reform of medical care and the delivery system could have been so much stronger in terms of compelling the system to reform in terms of efficiency and quality and effectiveness. Prevention and public health, while very much there, could have been stronger. Workforce reform could have been much more robust. So whatever aspect you pick, the people who understand those systems are very aware of how it could have been stronger. And at the same time, given the political realities in 2009 and 2010, I believe it's quite clear that there wasn't a stronger law that could have gotten through the House of Representatives and the Senate and gotten to the president's desk. So it could have been stronger in many ways, and it was probably the best that we were able to get. And even that was such a brief window of time. There's only about 7 months when there were 60 Democratic votes in the Senate, which were essential to the final passage of the law.
Well, Dr. McDonough, I think we could probably summarize the rest of it, and many of us felt as it was working its way through the system, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and stick with that grand goal of getting this national legislation passed. You've also used the word ironies to describe much of the Affordable Care Act, and you've said that it's fraught with ironies. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, there are innumerable ironies, but let me just mention two. So the first one, so Democrats very much preferred, in terms of the new insurance mechanisms through which people could buy health insurance if they need to, that are called health insurance exchanges, Democrats mostly wanted to have a single federal exchange. And some of the more moderate conservative voices in the Senate said, no, 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 we have to give the states the right to do this and only have the federal government step in when the states refuse to act, because every state's going to want to come in and do this. And since the law passed, what we've seen has been significant resistance to setting up these exchanges by the conservative and moderate, mostly Republican governors, who the law was set up to try to appeal to deliberately. So ironically, Democrats who wanted a federal exchange and conceded to have state exchanges will probably end up with a robust federal exchange because of the conservative Republican governors who are saying, no, we refuse to set up our own state exchange. So we're going to see a big federal presence in this in spite of what the law had envisioned. Secondly, a second irony is that in some ways the law is a massive transfer of wealth within the United States. It's a transfer from higher income, higher insurance coverage states like Massachusetts, New York, where the rate of uninsurance is low, to many Sun Belt red states where levels of uninsurance are extraordinarily high. So, for example, in Texas, about 1 out of 3 adults in Texas has no health insurance. It's just a staggering amount. The law, the ACA, was designed to send massive amounts of insurance coverage subsidies to these southern red states, And the governors of these states are now saying, we don't want that money. And so there's a lot of irony there.
John, let's take a look at the strongest aspects of the health care law and things that you saw implemented in Massachusetts that are working there and working well by most accounts. So let's talk about the pillars of the Affordable Care Act that stand poised to do what the law was intended to do to help the nation achieve the triple aim of access to care, improved quality of care, and better outcomes.
The first pillar is improving coverage. If the law is implemented as designed beginning in 2014, we should see a massive reduction in the percent of people in the United States who don't have health insurance. And if the law is fully implemented as it was intended, we should get that rate of coverage up to between 94 and 95%. The Supreme Court decision last June made the Medicaid expansions in the law an option for states. I am hopeful that at the end of the day, most states will in fact embrace and implement those Medicaid expansions. The second major piece is reforming the quality, efficiency, and effectiveness of medical care so that we do in fact provide the best quality care anybody can get anywhere. And the ACA includes many mechanisms which we can already see are having a significant effect in transforming the processes of care and the attention of the medical system to being really focused on improving the patient experience and improving the efficiency and effectiveness and quality of medical care. The third major piece is prevention and wellness and public health. And at the same time, we are seeing some significant steps forward, including the first ever in the history of the nation national prevention strategy to really move us away from a healthcare system that focuses only on taking care of people after they get sick and instead focusing on keeping people healthy and preventing them from getting sick in the first place.
Well, John, I'm going to give you an opportunity because I don't think it's been talked about enough to talk about that national preventive strategy.
So part of the Affordable Care Act is the direction to the United States Surgeon General to form a National Prevention Council. And their first major task was to develop a national prevention strategy for the nation. And they did that. It didn't get a lot of attention, and it's a terrific document. And what's interesting is not just the product itself, but how it was created. Because sitting around the table with the Surgeon General to create the strategy was not just the Department of Health and Human Services, but also the federal cabinet departments of education, housing and urban development, transportation, homeland security, the Justice Department, the Treasury Department, defense, 16 federal agencies, including the Environmental Protection Agency, and developed a blueprint not just for the Obama administration, but also for Congress, also for states, neighborhoods. So a really robust path to focus on how to keep the American public healthy. It's an embracing of a strategy that sometimes is referred to as health in all policies, where instead of just caring for people after they get sick, we figure out smart, creative, cost-effective ways to build in health prevention strategies so that people don't get sick in the first place. So a green and healthy homes approach says when we weatherize a home, let's also get rid of the things inside the home environment that make people sick and then have a significant amount of avoidable medical expenses down the line. I encourage people to take a look at the National Prevention Strategy.
We're speaking today with Dr. John McDonough, Director of the Center for Public Health Leadership at the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. McDonough served as a senior advisor on national health reform, helping us to craft the Affordable Care Act. He is author of three books, including Inside National Health Reform, published in 2011. John, your book has been lauded by numerous reviews as a definitive analysis, not just of the Affordable Care Act itself, but of the myriad political and cultural actions that brought us to this point in history. You know, we had David Gergen on the show recently, and he was lamenting the fact that we weren't able to pass this act with any Republican support, thought that didn't bode well. Tell me, where do you see the opportunity now that it starts to move out to the states, where we might see some of these red states, if you will, stand up and start to embrace this so that this can be a bill of national consensus?
The Affordable Care Act was designed from the get-go on the assumption that the only way that it could pass would be on a bipartisan basis with some significant Republican support. And for a long period of time, starting in 2007, 2008, going well into 2009, there were a number of Republicans who were very clearly working very hard to get to a place where it would be bipartisan. And in the intense political environment of 2009, with the emergence of the Tea Party and the resistance and reaction to President Obama and the administration, it became politically dangerous. The person who exemplifies this contradiction as much as anyone was Senator Chuck Grassley, who was the minority leader on the Senate Finance Committee, and who was, through most of 2009, working hand in glove with Senator Max Baucus, the Democratic chair's staff, to create a bipartisan health reform law. And Senator Grassley was quoted in June of 2009 as saying, listen, we've all got to be grown-ups and understand there's no way to get health reform done unless we have some kind of an individual mandate as a part of it. That was in June of 2009. In September of 2009, he was on Fox News again, and he said the reason he opposed health reform was because of the individual mandate. Mm-hmm. And so, and what happened in between June and September was the famous Tea Party town meeting of August 2009, and really, I think, put a major scare into many of the Republicans who were looking to be supportive. And I have a lot of respect for Senator Grassley. I think he's a terrific guy. But I think, you know, his response really reflects the intensely partisan and difficult political environment that existed in 2009 over this law that ultimately made it impossible for it to be bipartisan.
One of the issues that certainly has moved more to front and center as some of the politics have been resolved is the issue of cost containment in the delivery system. Tell us about where you see the most meaningful cost containment results in Massachusetts and how they might provide some input in a framework for containing costs nationally as we go forward.
So I think Massachusetts is still a work in progress. After the health reform law, otherwise known as Romney Care, passed in 2006, there was an immediate shift to conversing about what can we do to provide greater efficiency, effectiveness, and lowered costs of medical care in Massachusetts. And there have been a series of initiatives and laws that have been approved by the legislature. And the law that was passed this past July, signed by Governor Patrick in August, is probably the most ambitious.
John, let's talk a little bit about the recent talk that you gave at Harvard School of Public Health. And one of the areas that you addressed was around the most potential positive change within the healthcare system that might be coming through the use of technology. So help our listeners understand why these aspects of the health reform law are going to be the fundamental change agents in redesigning the healthcare system.
Having effective and useful data and analysis of that data on the performance of medical care in the medical care system is essential in terms of moving forward in the directions that we want. If we don't have the numbers to measure and understand what's most important, and if we can't agree on what those numbers are, then we're just going to be stuck in neutral and we're not going to move forward. So creating a robust health information technology system focusing on comparative effectiveness research through the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute is one of a series of foundational steps moving forward so that we have the mechanism to provide physicians, hospitals, and other folks in the healthcare delivery system with reliable and useful information about what works and what doesn't work. So there's significant movement forward on that. There are other things as well that are particularly important. I'll just mention just one example. Beginning this fall, hospitals that participate in the Medicare program, which is just about every hospital in the United States, are now facing today significant and growing financial penalties if they have rates of Medicare patient readmissions within 30 days that are excessively high, and if they have excessively high rates of hospital-acquired infections. So we are actually seeing embedded in the ACA the beginnings of a movement away from a trend over the past decade called paying for performance. And we are instead moving to a new platform that some people refer to as paying for outcomes. And there's significant work going on all around the country right now in a very, very positive way to get control of those measures so that hospitals don't face these new penalties.
We've been speaking today with Dr. John McDonough, Director of the Center for Public Health Leadership at the Harvard School of Public Health and co-architect of the health reform law in Massachusetts, as well as the Affordable Care Act. You can learn more about his work in health reform by Googling Inside National Health Reform or by going to hsph.edu. John, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report. Imagine an ultrasound wave so small, so precise, it can target a single cell within the body through the skin, penetrating that cell with laser-like precision. That's what electrical engineer Professor Jay Guo has concocted in his lab at the University of Michigan. A specialist in nanofluidics and nanobiotechnology, Dr. Guo has figured out a way to coat a lens with nanoparticles that help convert a laser light beam into a highly precise sound wave that is roughly the width of a human hair, a so-called invisible knife.
It's almost like an invisible knife. It doesn't cut through the tissue, but it does a therapeutic function inside the body.
That's Dr. Guo speaking with us via Skype from Shanghai. So how does the laser beam create this ultrasound knife? Well, Dr. Guo created a lens, kind of like a contact lens, and coated it with special nanoparticles that transfer that laser beam from light to sound.
So light incident onto this lens, now absorbed by the carbon nanotube, and then that turns into heat, and this heat is transferred to this rubber layer that produced the ultrasound.
The whole idea of developing ultrasound beams with high precision started with the idea that ultrasound waves are more harmless to adjacent tissue and don't harm flesh around a targeted area.
Because the precision now is much higher, so when you do these type of surgery, you could possibly avoid nerves, it only targets the region that need to be treated.
While he says he's not a doctor and more research needs to be done, there are any number of applications the invisible knife could be used for that would provide a painless, precise way to target some pesky enemies like kidney stones, cancer, and more.
The most effective treatment one is when the tumor is very tiny. And then also treating the tumor, you don't want to affect the nearby healthy tissues.
You can find out more about the work coming out of Dr. Guo's lab by Googling the Guo Research Lab, that's G-U-O, at the University of Michigan. His work was recently profiled in the publication Scientific Reports. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this tech report.
If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public radio station.